I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Members, we are going to start this afternoon. First of all, I'd like a motion to move the minutes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes for February 12, 2013.
All right. Representative Benson moves to approve the minutes of February 6th, I think they are, right?
February 6th.
February 6th.
You're right.
Yes.
Looking at today.
Yes, thank you.
Although it seems like yesterday, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Benson. So we're going to start today with an overview. We have four bills on the agenda that all relate to children's mental health. And so Ms. Aves from House Research, our nonpartisan House Research, is going to start us out by giving us a little bit of an overview of the children's mental health system. And this is part of our ongoing attempt to try to learn and understand a little bit more about the system that we have. And then after that, just to give people, members and the audience, a roadmap for today, we're going to, after we have that overview, we're going to hear from some testifiers about these issues. Since we have these four bills and they are all on the same general topic and they in fact overlap in some respects, we're going to hear from some testifiers first. We're going to take some public testimony, then we're going to hear the bills, and I'm going to ask the testifiers to please stay so that there can be questions as we go through the bills. But I hope in this way to have a more unified discussion and be able to look at the topic a little bit more holistically. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Aves.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lynn Aves. I'm with the Research Department here at the House of Representatives. I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of the children's mental health system. In Minnesota, the entire mental health system is state-supervised and county-administered. There are specific statutes regarding the children's mental health system and the responsibilities of counties and the state. The state statute requires the Commissioner of Human Services to create a comprehensive children's mental health system that identifies children eligible to receive mental health services, makes preventive services available, assures access to a continuum of services, includes early screening and prompt intervention when mental health needs are identified. It's to include the child and the child's family in planning the most appropriate treatment for the child. It is to provide services in the community in which the child lives and attends school, and it is to ensure that mental health services that are begun when an individual is a child transition with the child as they become an adult so that there is no breakdown in the services for the child. This section of the statute also requires the commissioner to seek funding from all other sources available that are non-state and like non-county, non-governmental funds. The county boards are responsible for development and coordination of locally available and affordable children's mental health services, and they can provide these services either through the county agencies or through contracts with providers. These services that are the responsibilities of the counties include education, prevention, and intervention services, emergency and crisis intervention services, outpatient services, and more intensive services for children with severe emotional disturbance, such as case management, day treatment, home-based family treatment services. They also provide residential treatment for children with severe emotional disturbance, inpatient hospital treatment, and screening services. According to DHS, approximately 109,000 children and young adults from birth to age 21 need treatment for serious emotional disturbances. It's estimated that 9% of school age and 5% of preschool children have a serious emotional disturbance. and that approximately 68,000 children and youth receive publicly funded mental health services. Most of these are home-based and community services like case management, day treatment, therapy, but 24% of the children's mental health funding is for residential and inpatient services. In 2007, there was a mental health initiative that's kind of commonly called the Governor's Mental Health Initiative that appropriated about $34 million to improve the quality and accessibility of publicly funded mental health care for children and adults. Funds were also appropriated to develop and support evidence-based best practices and to create a system to measure mental health treatment outcomes. Among funds appropriated for children were school-based mental health services, respite care for families of children with severe emotional disturbances, crisis intervention and stabilization, and also to provide a rate increase for providers of children's therapeutic services and supports. And this was done in an effort to address workforce shortages so more services would be available and more providers would be available to provide these services. Public and private health care and human services provide mental health treatment and care for children. In addition, there are grants to help pay for treatment for children when they're uninsured or the family's insurance doesn't provide mental health services. In the current biennium, approximately $34 million was appropriated for various children's mental health grants. Among these grants were approximately $9.5 million for school-based mental health services. During the 2011-12 school year, nearly 6,400 students received services. 58% of these were for the first time. $5.2 million was appropriated for crisis services. These are grants that were given to counties for regional partnerships to provide crisis intervention and stabilization services. During calendar year 2011, there were 2,600 crisis episodes, and of these, 61% were initial contacts with the children in the mental health system. $2.7 million was appropriated for respite services. These are services for families and children when children have severe emotional disturbance and the stress often in families becomes very great and they kind of need a break from each other. Approximately 1,400 children were served in fiscal year 11. And $8.8 million was for grants to county child welfare and juvenile justice agencies to provide mental health screening and follow-up assessment for children involved in the child welfare or the juvenile justice system. And in calendar year 11, approximately 11,000 children were served. There are other grants that were given as well, but I didn't write down all of the information to provide you today. There's information in the budget books if you care for more information.
Thank you, Ms. Aves. Does anybody have questions for Ms. Aves before we move on? Just general questions about the system. And just so members know, these bills will all go to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. So, they're going to the Early Childhood Committee. They're going to Representative Mullery's committee next. Bottom line is, in this committee, we don't need to worry about the funding so much. It's really, we're hearing them as policy, the policy parts of this right now. But questions for Ms. Aves? Okay, thank you very much. So next up, we are going to hear from Sue Abderholden. And this is Christy Collier. Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on how to improve our children's mental health system. You do have three handouts. One of them is the Mental Health Legislative Network's booklet, and if you turn to page 13, we've actually given you some charts to help you understand the delivery of the children's mental health system in terms of, it's being handed out now, in terms of who funds basic clinical services, what the community services and supports are, hospital and residential treatment, along with the cost and numbers and outcome data. So I just thought it might be helpful. We were going to be delivering these anyway this week, and I thought we'd wait for the committee so that you could have it. About 21% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 have a diagnosable mental illness or substance use disorder, but only 20% will actually receive treatment. Left untreated, it impacts their ability to do well in school, at home, and in the community. And without treatment, they're likely to face multiple suspensions, do poorly in school, drop out, end up in the juvenile justice system, become homeless, or even die by suicide. You have a sheet that has data from the Minnesota Student Surveys. 17% of 7th graders in 2010 had suicidal thoughts. That's 8,055 teens. 3% actually tried to take their own lives, and that's 1,422 7th graders. We know that statewide in 2010 there were 599 suicides. 39 were between the ages of 15 and 19. And 6 were between the ages of 10 and 14.
Ms. Afterholden, I think you might be a bit ahead of us again. I think we're just getting some of these pages right now.
Okay.
And I know you're trying to be efficient with our time, but
yes.
I want members to... It's hard when you hear a lot of numbers and you're not looking at anything, so...
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
These are coming around.
There's a one-pager that has the student survey data.
So that's this one, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
And so you can see that it's a... You know, while it might not seem 6% or 7% might not seem like a lot when you take it times the number of students in those grades, again, that's a pretty 8,000 children. Teens just in that grade alone is really quite high and should be concerning to all of us.
And Ms. Afterholden, could you take just a second to tell us how this data is collected?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is collected actually by the Minnesota Department of Health, and they publish the data every year. It's a survey that's taken across the state by clearly a number of students, and it's compared from year to year. And the questions are typically the same. Every now and then the health department may add a question or two, but typically they're the same questions from year to year, so you can compare the data.
Thank you. Please continue.
I do want to point out that families really face multiple barriers in accessing mental health treatment for their child. Insurance may not cover mental health treatment. Just a reminder that mental health parity does not require coverage for mental health or substance use disorder treatment. It just says if you cover it, then you have to do it in the same way. They may have very high deductibles, or they may not have insurance at all. And if that happens, they typically have to depend on the county dollars, which frankly can be more difficult. Ms. Aves did point out the Children's Mental Health Act, but there's not a lot of teeth in there because it says that you only have to do this within available appropriations. And during the last biennium, about $14 million was cut from the Children and Community Services Act that used to go to fund children's mental health. So the counties have even less dollars than they did before. Other families face barriers related to transportation, maybe not being able to take off of work, mistrust of the system, and particularly long waiting lists to get in, especially to a psychiatrist. You know, we really don't have the range of options that families need. Parents of children who are experiencing serious symptoms of mental illness are typically told that their children don't meet hospital level of care. Schools are concerned that children are discharged from a hospital and come back the next day to their schools without supports, and they're kind of at a loss in terms of what to do. Police are frustrated when parents refuse to take their child home from, say, an emergency room or a hospital because they say they can't keep their child safe or their other children safe from that particular child. The police then are required to take that child to a shelter, and the families also end up in the child welfare system with a CHIPS petition or medical neglect charges being filed. But the reality is they have nowhere to take their child, and just taking them home isn't enough. If we really want to address the problems in our adult mental health system, we have to address the problem in our children's mental health system. Roughly half of all adults who live with a serious mental illness began experiencing symptoms before the age of 14. So again, we know if we want to provide early intervention and supports, we can't wait until they're adults. The bills you're going to hear this afternoon address a variety of barriers and problems in our children's mental health system. And this is really, I would say, the first intensive look at our system since the 2007 Bipartisan Mental Health Initiative. And even then, I want to point out, we only received a percentage of what was requested. Several of us who work on children's mental health went back and reviewed all the past reports, including the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, the Intensive Needs Report, to see what recommendations had not yet been implemented. We also examined what is working in our system and then brainstormed about what other things could be done. And so what you have really before the whole legislature is 12 bills that have been introduced to try to improve the system. And the bills underscore the need for early detection, diagnosis, and treatment. You'll hear some more about school-linked mental health services, which have been incredibly effective and an important program. We would also expand respite care. I'm actually a respite care provider. I have a foster care license, and I see how families are when they come on Friday. They look horrible. They come back on Sunday. They've been able to sleep. They've been able to maybe do the dishes, be with their other children and their family, and they come back rested. Family peer specialists is something new, and that would be created to really address both our workforce issue, but also to ensure that services are family-friendly and family-driven, and that families have someone to connect with who's really kind of been there, done that, which actually increases the informal support that they have in the community. There are important additions being made to our MA benefits set, including care coordination, consultation, assessment, and inreach. We're paying special attention to those transition age years, 14 to 26. I like to say that 26 is the new 18. We know that those are real critical years in terms of moving from one system to another. There's a strong focus on first psychotic episode programs. We know that if we intervene with the intensity that's needed, you know, and the right medications, these mental illnesses might not become disabling conditions. We can reduce symptoms, reduce hospitalizations, improve functioning, and increase their quality of life. We're trying to increase our community's children's mental health literacy through mental health first aid and helping them understand mental illnesses and how to respond in a crisis. And we're also trying to reduce mental health care disparities by providing additional training for community health workers. We know that these bills aren't perfect. We worked very fast and furious to put them together, but NAMI has always pledged us to work with the other stakeholders, counties, health plans, DHS, staff, etc., to address any concerns, create a consensus, and move forward on this important issue.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to kind of piggyback on your question that you asked. I understand, Ms. Abderholden, that it's the health department that develops the question, but how do you go about, does every public school student take, is it a survey, or can you just expound on this a little bit more, and is it mandatory? Thank you.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, not working for the health department, I can't tell you all the ins and outs of that survey. We just look at the data. It is a high number of students who actually take it. I believe it's offered in every school. I also believe that students can opt out and not take it. But I think I would have to find out the exact answer to that question for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'd really appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Abderholden before we go on? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, I remember in an earlier session we were dealing with the lack of inpatient beds for adolescents, particularly who were experiencing serious episodes. And part of the feedback we got was that part of that was because there wasn't the community-based services to move people out. They might be ready for discharge, but there was no one to help them in that transition or stabilization period. And I don't think I've heard something recently about how we're doing on making that a little bit more robust so that we can move people quickly through.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we've not made a lot of progress in that area. We're still finding that, it may be difficult to get a hospital bed when it's needed, and we've not developed those additional community resources that we think would actually help. You know, we have crisis teams, which prevent hospitalizations, but we don't have mobile children's crisis teams in every county. So we need to kind of work a little bit more on there. So we know what works, we just haven't gotten there and haven't funded it.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And Ms. Abderholden, please don't go far because we'll probably have more questions. And let's get to Ms. Collier and then we'll have more questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Christy Collier, and I am the mother of a 10th grader that is living with bipolar, ADHD, and Asperger's. At an early age, I detected that my child was demonstrating symptoms of something that wasn't a typical phase. When she was in elementary school, I was told that she was just precocious and that this in time would pass. At home, I observed what would be best described as meltdowns. She would cry for hours until she vomited. She would vomit when she was angry. She would scream until she fell asleep. There was property destruction and self-injurious behavior. School saw that she didn't do well with peers and that she struggled in various learning areas and that she showed a flight or fight demeanor. She struggled with passing times and required extra supervision in the hallways. Always fell apart at lunchtime, did crying at school until she vomited, which generally resulted in the school nurse calling me, insisting that she was sick, which as a single mother required me to leave work time and time again. There was a moderate difference between home and school. However, it was clear that they had seen enough to warrant regular phone calls home. They even once entered into a line of questioning about what was happening at home and perhaps I needed some new parenting skills. My daughter had her first rage at school in fourth grade. She tossed chairs. She kicked, hit, and sobbed uncontrollably. But because the school personnel lacked the necessary training and there was not school-linked mental health program, the response was not appropriate, nor was it helpful. In front of everyone, all of her classmates and other school personnel, she was pulled out of the room by her wrists into the hallway, her body thrashing about, and the school staff was running around trying to intervene in this crisis without a plan in place. This crisis was viewed by everyone and laid the groundwork for future bullying. I wish that my concerns had been taken seriously, and I wish that there had been school-linked mental health services. First, the school would have had someone who was trained to understand mental illness and could have identified what was happening earlier and worked with me and the school staff. And second, it would have been easier for me as a single mother with getting her consistent mental health services and getting her needs met in the school environment and possibly avoiding other costly, expensive services. Instead, what happened since that first crisis, she has been hospitalized 5 times, spent 2 days, was in day treatment 2 times, and 3 specialized school settings. It has been an incredibly difficult road. I am saddened to think about all of the children who have continued to go without services. I come here to you today urging you to strengthen the children's mental health system, especially school-linked mental health services. Our children in our need, please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collier. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions, and please do stick around in case there are questions. Tom Steinmetz, and then Mary Regan after him. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Steinmetz. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Washburn Center for Children, which is a 130-year-old nonprofit children's mental health agency located in Minneapolis. In 2012, Washburn Center for Children provided about 9,000 hours of service for just under 500 students through school-linked mental health services, which we provide in 18 public schools in Minneapolis, Bloomington, and Eden Prairie. As Sue mentioned earlier, the lack of access to mental health services is a serious public health issue in Minnesota. 1 in 5 children qualify for a diagnosable mental health disorder, yet only 20% of those children will receive therapeutic services. When children who need mental health services don't receive help, they are much more likely to develop serious and more expensive difficulties. We also know that schools are the most common place that emerging mental health difficulties are first identified, and the school-based mental health model, in which a community mental health agency provides a therapist who works directly on-site in a school, is highly effective at connecting students with needed mental health services. A national study estimated that when schools referred students to clinics outside of the school, only about 15% of those students actually ended up receiving services. While in Minnesota's school-based mental health project, 85% of students who are referred end up receiving services. The 21 statewide school-linked mental health projects have provided effective mental health services to thousands of children who otherwise would not have received help, just under 7,000 children last school year. Minnesota's collaboration includes urban, suburban, and rural projects in 63 counties, about 200 school districts, and over 550 schools. Data from the Minnesota Kids Database, which is a collaboratively developed statewide database which tracks outcomes for school-based mental health services, shows that about 60% of the children seen are getting mental health treatment for the first time, even though 45% of the students seen were identified as having a serious emotional disturbance. These students were truly falling through the cracks and suffering because services were not available and accessible. Access to school-based mental health services has also been quick and responsive. Students are seen within 10 days of initial referral on average, which is significantly quicker than what is available in community outpatient clinics, which often have waiting lists or delays of 1 to 3 months. The mental health professional is right on site so they can see the child and family quickly in a place that is familiar and convenient for them. Most importantly, school mental health services are effective. School principals and social workers report that schooling mental health services reduce suspensions and behavioral issues, help to reduce or prevent the need for special education services, and improved attendance and academic performance, in addition to data which shows reductions in symptoms and improvement in functioning in school and at home. And for clients served through Washburn, 100% of the parents served at Washburn's school-based sites said that they would recommend these services to a friend who was in need of similar help. As one parent wrote to us a year ago, "Kyle could not leave the yard to catch the school bus without running back in tears, riddled with fear. He couldn't get past his fear enough to focus on his schoolwork, and by lunch was so agitated and upset that he couldn't see the positive in anything. Today he skips to the school bus stop, excited to socialize with his friends before the bus comes. He enjoys his school day and the friends he keeps close. Never in a million years would I have thought we would be where we are today. He is truly an entirely different boy. He has been able to mature emotionally and have the childhood that he should. You have no idea the gift you have given our family. I will never be able to forget how you saved him. You really did." There are thousands of other stories like this one. This approach really works. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Steinmetz. I'm not seeing questions right now, but please stick around for a bit if you can. Thank you. Mary Regan and then Alma Marquez is next, and then Charles Schultz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide membership association for providers of services to children and adolescents. Our 46 member organizations operate over 300 programs around the state, serving children with mental health, juvenile justice, child welfare, and needs, as well as homeless youth. The children's mental health system in Minnesota includes a continuum of services. The continuum includes outpatient services offered by community mental health centers, private professionals, and other agencies, in-home treatment services, school-linked services, day treatment, residential treatment, partial hospital, and inpatient services. These programs in total serve children from early childhood through adolescence and into early adulthood and their families. You've already heard some about school-linked mental health services, and we'll hear more, so I want to focus today on some of the other services in the continuum. When I began my career in Minnesota in 1982 at a residential treatment center, there were about 1,200 residential treatment beds in Minnesota, and the average length of stay in the program that I worked at was 3.5 years. The average length of stay at the specialty psychiatric hospital that Abbott Northwestern operated was 6 months. Today, there are about 800 residential treatment beds with an average length of stay of 7 months, and the average length of stay for hospitals is 7 days. Part of the change can be attributed to the development of this continuum of community-based services that can keep more children at home, out of more intensive services such as residential treatment and hospitals, and in school. And another change that's happened over this time, Ms. Aves talked about the Children's Mental Health Act and the responsibility of counties to provide mental health services for children. But one of the things that has happened over time has been a shift of many of the services that counties originally funded to being funded under medical assistance. And that's an appropriate shift because these are health care services. But unfortunately, that we have lost a lot of the funding that counties used to provide as part of a package. Counties were often partners with providers to fund those pieces that medical assistance or other funding streams couldn't support. One example of the community-based services that has made a difference in the intensity and the cost for children is called Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. This is a comprehensive package of services, psychotherapy for children and their families, skill development services to restore or develop healthy functioning, and behavioral aid services to provide support for children and families as they practice what they learn in therapy. And these services can be delivered in the child's home, in the school, in other community settings that work for individual families. The services are brought to the families, which allows many of them, despite frequent barriers of distance and transportation, to have access to these services. They can also be offered as a package in conjunction with education as day treatment for those children who need more intensive services. Unfortunately, these services are not available across the state. Nor are they funded to cover anything other than direct services. So key activities like ongoing assessment and evaluation, consultation with other professionals, and coordination with schools and teachers are not covered. CTSS providers have no option to get paid for these key activities or to spend time with families, helping them understand their child's mental illness, what the treatment options are, and ongoing assessment of appropriateness for those treatment options. This especially is an issue in early childhood mental health services. Some families are understandably reluctant to consider what's happening to their children to be related to mental illness. Despite the growing availability of effective interventions, these children, who may be repeatedly getting kicked out of daycare, may not get the service they need without the support of providers who can help explain what's going on, help families understand what the symptoms mean. We do know what works, and we know about the importance of a continuity of care across services. Many of the components of the bills you will hear today contain provisions that address critical gaps in the service system. Some of them are the direct result of input from families, educators, and case managers who participated in listening sessions we jointly held with the Department of Human Services Children's Mental Health Division across the state in 2011. Consistent themes from those sessions were the need for care coordination, transition planning, and more information, and respite care for families. The area of transition and longer-term support is an area where our members are working hard to develop a continuity of care model that would ensure ongoing care without disruptions and without forcing families to keep re-engaging with new providers. The model includes identifying children who appear to be on a track for significant mental health interventions and significant long-term residential treatment. After the initial identification, the families offered intensive community-based services. If placement is still needed, the community-based therapist continues their work with that family while the child is in placement. And the placement is typically very much abbreviated. I said earlier average length of stay is 7 months. With this model, the average length of stay has been 45 days. They then continue the intensive work with the child and family for up to 1 year following the treatment. Right now, that effort is being piloted by two residential treatment programs in collaboration with CTSS agencies, and the data suggests that long-term functioning and stability at home are much improved, in addition to the cost savings of a shorter length of stay in residential treatment. But the funding for this is being cobbled together through arrangements with counties, medical assistance, and private insurance. And funding for care coordination and transition planning would support providing this to many more children and families. In addition to the proposals for additional services, I also want to say a few words in support of the proposal of survey providers regarding the impact of their interactions with health plans that manage Minnesota medical assistance. As providers have worked hard to become cost-effective and efficient as possible, they have ideas and feedback to share with the department that we hope could result in some standardization of processes and cost savings for all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm not seeing any questions right now, but we hope you'll stick around for a while in case there are some a little bit later. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of the House File 358. My name is Alma Marquez, and I am a school-based children's mental health therapist at Wilder Foundation in St. Paul, Minnesota. Every day I work with children and families with complex emotional and behavioral issues. These are your citizens and the citizens that will be most directly impacted by this legislation. I'm here in support of the proposed legislation that includes mental health care coordination and clinical case consultation for children and adolescents. In order to do our jobs well, therapists need to be actively communicating with the many individuals involved in the child's care. People like primary care doctors, psychiatrists, family members, and school staff. We do this to prevent relapse and further deterioration. This school year, I am working in an innovative service created by a partnership between Wilder Foundation and St. Paul Public Schools. I deliver mental health care at an elementary school with the expectation that I spend as much time doing care coordination and clinical case consultation as each child needs. As a result, children are stabilizing in shorter time frames and are experiencing success in less intensive services. I'd like to share one of those examples with you. In September, I met a 6-year-old boy in the first grade classroom who was referred by his teacher for high-risk behaviors like running out of class, jumping flights of stairs, banging his head against walls, and was constantly being suspended and dismissed. An assessment with his mother revealed a history of traumatic experiences, high-risk behaviors at home as well, abnormal sleep patterns, and extreme prenatal exposure to drugs and alcohol. In addition, the child was in significant emotional distress and at times was attempting and intending to hurt himself. It took many hours of care coordination and clinical consultation for this child to finally be admitted to a hospital and later to a day treatment program. After starting the program, it took consistent consultation with a team of psychiatry, psychology, nurses, and therapists for me to prepare his school and home for his return a month later. When this 6-year-old returned to school, his medication was administered by the school nurse. His classroom had the same crawling tunnel that he used in day treatment for him to take his quiet relaxation breaks. I was able to continue his therapy, knowing exactly where his day treatment therapist left off. His teacher was prepared with the language and strategies for coaching his emotional regulation. The school social worker had already prepared a plan for completing his evaluation for special education services, and we matched the family with the Ramsey County Children's Mental Health case manager to work with mom on future appointments and care needs. I had to be instrumentally involved in coordinating each one of those pieces. The coordination of care and clinical case consultation with other providers allow children to have all of the adults in their world on the same page, knowing what works for them, what triggers them, what helps and supports successful and safe development. Prior to the start of this unique pilot program, I worked as a therapist in the traditional capacity at COFI Services for 2 years without the opportunity, ability, or time to focus on care coordination and consultation. As providers, we can do better in delivering mental health services to children and families, and supporting our ability to do care coordination and clinical case consultation is the way to do it. I hope you support this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Marquez. Appreciate it. If you can stick around, that'd be great. And I'm not seeing any questions right now, but there may be some later. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Charles Schultz, and I need to make clear I am the other Charles Schultz. I'm the head of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to note that before I came here and worked at the National Institute of Mental Health, I initiated the Public Academic Liaison Program for the government, a program that pulls together the medical schools with the community care organizations, state hospitals, and it's really delightful to me to be able to collaborate with People Incorporated, with NAMI, with SAVE, and to make sure that our university brings its educational activities to those organizations, and of course, vice versa, as we learn so much from them. Ms. Abderholden asked me if I might comment on three items. The first is, what is a first episode, or what is a first episode program? What is the optimal treatment in a first episode program, and what are some of the problems or the weak points? I'd like to note that first episode schizophrenia, or a first episode psychosis, is the onset of schizophrenia in which there is a loss of touch of reality. There are hallucinations in which a young person is hearing voices, commenting on their behavior, and sometimes, quite sadly, also directing behavior, and sometimes in a very bad direction. We know that there are false beliefs and paranoid feelings, and those can be quite isolating for a young person and really disrupt their social life and their ability to participate in school. One of the newer findings about the first onset of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder is not only the loss of touch with reality and the voices, etc., as I've described, but also the cognitive decline that occurs. Disability and sustained attention, difficulty with short-term memory, things that really disrupt a young person being able to be engaged in school, be able to move ahead with their occupational career. Sue then said, if this severe illness has an onset, what is the optimal way for us to approach this illness? And I'd like to say the very first thing in my experience over a number of decades working with these young people is to make sure to make an outstanding connection with the young person and with their family. This is such a horrifying experience to have that we have to make sure we form an outstanding relationship with the young person and their mom and dad, who I'm sure we can all understand are devastated by this. We need to make sure that the young person's health has been examined, because there are medical issues that can lead to a psychosis. And we don't want to be treating a onset of schizophrenia if it is caused by a metabolic disorder or a brain lesion. So we have to make sure that the person has been very well and very carefully assessed. We know that there has been a new phrase called duration of untreated psychosis, or DUP. The longer the time goes from the onset of hallucinations and delusions and a person first receives medication is associated with much poorer outcome, socially, occupationally, and symptomatically. So after we have made a connection with the family, after we have made an evaluation, we want to introduce the appropriate and evidence-based medications, and we want to make sure we provide the appropriate support and talking therapies with the young person. We also want to make sure that we provide family psychoeducation. Parents are devastated, and they have no idea what this is all about in general. We find that the moms and dads are very, very pleased with their psychoeducation, and we feel that as we do this in a group setting, that the moms and dads begin to develop a relationship, and they don't feel as isolated as you can imagine they would otherwise. As the treatment begins to take an effect, we know we need to make sure to assist a young person in reengaging in their education, or if they're maybe slightly out of school, to make sure we are able to assist them in an occupational treatment. I would like to say that we have had a number of young people who have had the onset of psychosis near the end of high school or early in college, and we have now had, with people participating in our first episode program, a number of people graduate with a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota. And we feel that that is in part because of the comprehensive program and the early intervention. Sue asked me to also say a word about what some of the problems are. One of the big problems is long duration of untreated psychosis. Can you imagine that the average before some of these programs got started was a year or two before a mom and dad might bring a young person in, before a young person might say what's going on? So one of the things that we need to do is make sure we make our community aware of the need to identify a psychotic illness and to get a person treated. And that has been a big problem. The other problem is a disruption of the system. It's part of the reason why we wanted to initiate a first episode program. But as you can imagine, if a young person comes into the hospital, they may get some really good treatment, maybe for a couple of weeks, then they're discharged, and things begin to break up for them. They throw their medicine away. A couple months later, they're back in the hospital. And we know that every single time there's a relapse, longer and longer period of time before that person is able to get back to their baseline. And they don't always do that. We also know that we have not always created the programs that provide the family psychoeducation, the occupational support, the cognitive treatments. And what we have found by looking at the literature in our own first episode program, it's important to put all of these things together. Well, I think I'd like to conclude by again thanking Ms. Abderholden, not only for including me to come today, but also she has been such a great partner for the Department of Psychiatry, and really appreciate that link also with my friend Tim Burkett. We are working very hard on training our medical students and our residents and child and adolescent fellows about the recognition and treatment of first episode psychosis, and we want to be able to be supported by the state to be able to move ahead so that we're very constructive with these young people. And thank you very much for letting me come today.
Thank you, Dr. Schultz. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Schultz, thank you for your information. I'm an old nurse. I go way back.
You look like a young nurse to me.
Thank you. To the 60s, and in the nursing home where we did house patients who were the later stages of schizophrenia. And also, I mean, this has been going on forever. And now to, you know, my question is, why do we wait so long to have a first episode analysis of our schizophrenic population? And also, what is the youngest age that you can diagnose schizophrenia?
Dr. Schultz.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments that this has been going on for a long time and has been a really major challenge for us. I think some of the reasons that the literature says that the time is so long is the young person doesn't want to say this to their parents or to anybody else, and they may have the delusional symptoms or actually be hearing voices for many months or up to a year before they tell anybody. You just can't quite see it from the outside. But it also turns out I have evaluated many young people and their moms and dads, and I think we can all understand the mom and dad, when they hear this, don't necessarily think, oh my goodness, I need to help with treatment. Or they may actually deny that something is going on. And I had one mother tell me that rather than taking her son for care, she would light a candle by his bedside and kneel down and pray for him every night for his voices to go away. So we really know that we need to get out into the community and make these interventions and the need for intervention very clear. I appreciate your question.
And I appreciate your answer. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your answer, but the symptoms are so obvious that, you know, I think that the medical community, all of us, need to do more educating. And I think the fear is still, I think the fear of it is huge yet with parents and the like, society. Still, that a huge, people fear the unknown. And I do think that when we do see, because in my life, I see good results of patients in my own community. We have a, what they call a friendship house where they I visit and interact and meet with folks there, and they're happy to have the ability to be out and to socialize and to have a life, and their symptoms are managed. And so I think that the more that we can talk about this and educate people and do the better we can manage the symptoms and give people the dignity of having the family and the patient themselves of having some stability in life and with the management of it. But it still is a there's a stigma, still a strong stigma attached to the schizophrenia diagnosis.
Okay, Dr. Schultz, I don't know if you wanted to respond.
If I could just respond by thanking you very much and pointing out the importance of our engaging and educating our community. The only other point I'd make is, as a nurse, I'm sure you're aware that there are nonspecific symptoms leading up to this onset of schizophrenia, odd thoughts, withdrawal, poor performance in school, called the prodrome, and we need to also get the word out about that. I'm going to lecture to the University of Minnesota Student Health tomorrow afternoon so that they're able to recognize that when it appears to them. And I appreciate your comments very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to call on Representative Grunhagen in a second, but I just want to let members know that we have the four bills. They all are pretty interconnected. We're going to hear them after we get through a couple more testifiers. And then we do have the room reserved at 6 o'clock. If we don't get to vote on the bills, we'll come back at 6. So we can go a little bit late in this room till about 4 o'clock as well. So just letting members know what our time frame is, not wanting to cut anyone off. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question's for Dr. Schultz and also Ms. Aberholden, if she's available.
Well, why don't you go ahead and ask Representative Grunhagen while she comes down.
Yeah, I've, you know, this is a very difficult area, and I know families that have been helped a lot through intervention. Several families, one of them happens to be my sister-in-law, and they do some great work in helping families manage a very difficult situation. And I think we've seen the testimony of Ms. Collier as a parent to have a very difficult and depressing situation that hopefully can be improved. One of the things I noticed of at least two bills, it looks like there's some coordination with school-based school-based mental health programs. And, you know, as a school board member, one of the things that I ran into was that sometimes there were programs introduced into the schools without parental knowledge and that had questionnaires that were given to the entire class that seemed to probe into the child's family situation and without any, you know, let's put it this way, there's obvious physical and behavioral symptoms that need to be dealt with, okay? I understand that, and I don't have any problem with that. But where parents became concerned in my school district, and it ultimately became a school board issue, was that this particular curriculum, well, the name of it, and this was several years ago, the name of it was My Family and Me, Violence Free. And it came through our local McLeod County Alliance Against Domestic Violence. And they brought questionnaires in, I think it was either the fifth or sixth grade, and without parental permission, they ask, in fact, I got copies of the curriculum yet, by the way, at home, because I got quite involved in this process. And they asked the children in the entire classroom questions, probing questions, some of them, like I said, dealing with the family. So it's as if they were looking for or probing for problems versus, you know, having a physical or behavioral problem to be seen. My question is this, is when these types of questionnaires, if they're brought into the schools, I always thought they should have signed parental permission before they administer them to the general classroom as a whole. And, you know, just, Ms. Abner-Holden, if you want to respond to that in any way.
Yes.
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I can't speak to the student survey. I mean, I'm going to go back and get that information for you. But in terms of the school-linked mental health services, there's no questionnaires that are distributed. The referrals are made by teachers, by special educators, by school psychologists, school nurses, even families. And before any child is treated, you have to have parental permission.
Okay.
Just one quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Okay, but in terms of administering these questionnaires to students in the classroom at a young age without parental permission, I mean, I just think that we should have a, that if they're going to administer a questionnaire like that in a general classroom situation, they should have parental permission before doing so.
Yeah. Well, Representative Grunhagen, I think she's saying she's that's kind of not something she's responsible for. Probably we could get someone else to speak to that, but I think it's a little bit off of the subjects of the bill right now. But we could get Ms. Abner-Holden, did you want to comment?
I will get the information on how the student survey is conducted and get that back to the committee.
Because she mentioned a survey.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Representative Franza.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Abner-Holden, I'm just on your section four here. I'm just curious to know if there's any studies that are done on the children that come from a nuclear family and from versus children that are in a broken home and how that correlates to any mental illness. Are there any studies that are done or...
Madam Chair, Representative, there is actually, there's one called the ACE study, which looks at adverse childhood experiences. But because mental illness is also genetic, it can happen to a family that is intact, that is functioning, happened to my family. It can happen to anyone. Representative Greiling, if she was here, would tell you, schizophrenia occurred in her family and, you know, they were... you know, find family. So we do know that, you know, some children are more resilient than others, but I can bring a summary of the ACE study to you, and I think you'll find it very interesting and very helpful. Certainly the more adverse experiences a child has, the more likely they are and more at risk they are for developing a mental illness.
I have Representative Albright, and then we'll let Jim.
Could I make one comment? And I really appreciate
Dr. Schultz.
Your question about that. I would like to note that your point about family disturbance and Ms. Abner-Holden's response that, yes, that can have an impact. I would like to make clear that a lot of times there are discussions about overly concise or maybe even overly neuroscientific interventions for a young person. And I think we know from what Sue has said the importance of making sure we provide the appropriate emotional support and therapy for the young person and their family for them to have the best outcome, to assist them in dealing with things that can happen from a broken home. And I appreciate you bringing that up. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Ms. Abner-Holden, I'm sorry for the... with regard to the same study...
Representative Albright, if you could just move your mic a little closer. There we go.
Could you just respond to what the size of the sample group for this study was?
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Madam Chair, I could work it backwards, knowing that 3% was 1,422. You could kind of work backward with the math. I don't have the full document with me. And now I'm really sorry that I ever brought the document with me. but, I mean, really what I was just trying to show is that you have these students who are feeling suicidal. 8,000 is a lot. Another 1,400 just in that grade alone who attempted it. And so that we do have children out there that are struggling with their mental health. But I will provide members with all the background about how this is conducted and the full numbers to you.
Okay, Representative Albright, and then after you just do one. Your follow-up, I'm going to let the next two testifiers finish up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, to the study here, I'm just curious, if I look at the from left to right and most of these categories, there seems to be either a static or a slight decline in the number of occurrences. I'm just wondering if there's any attribution to intervention or if it's something that has been drawn out of this that you could speak to about why and the wherefore from 98 to 2010.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would hope it's because we have schooling to mental health services, and so that for some children they're getting the help that they need, but that would be pure conjecture on my part, and I don't think we have, you know, anything that we can clearly correlate.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call on Tim Burkett, if you would introduce yourself. Thank you for your patience. And then we've got Patrick Coyne, and then we will go to the bills. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Tim Burkett. I'm the CEO of People Incorporated. People Incorporated is the largest provider of services to people with mental illness in the state of Minnesota. We served 7,000 people in seven counties last year. And I want to applaud you guys for focusing this afternoon on mental health services for children. We serve adults in residential programs. We serve adults in treatment programs. We have clinical programs for adults. We have homeless programs. We have case management. And we have crisis. And then there are our children's programs. And it is our children's programs, I think, that are the most vitally important in preventing thousands of folks from moving on to careers as disabled, disempowered members of our society. Yet only a fraction of the money that we spend in the United States, in Minnesota, and also in my home state, to help support people with mental illness in the community goes to kids. I think there are two reasons for that, and I think they've kind of both been identified today. The first is stigma. Parents, teachers, these labels are it's one thing to be told that your 14-year-old has incipient diabetes, but to be told that your 14-year-old may have schizophrenia, because there's been so much stigma, because there's been so much devaluing of people with these labels, we haven't labeled them. We've been afraid. Secondly, they're not disabled yet. The 6,000 clients that we serve who are already disabled, they're adults. So somebody's got to do something. I mean, they're in bad shape. They're not in their parents' homes anymore. And they're expensive once they become disabled. So I think those are the two reasons we haven't done enough early intervention. Dr. Schultz was talking about early onset. So my sister, when she was about, I'm trying to remember, but about 14, she told my other sister that she was, people were following her. People would follow her home from high school and junior high and then high school. And we believed at first that people were following her. After a while, my sister and I began to wonder, what's the deal here? We never see anybody who's following her, and they seem to change shapes and sizes. But we were afraid to tell my mother. We knew my mother would be on Charlotte's case. So we didn't tell anybody for a couple years, but my sister then just started to get weird. And so from the age of 14 to 19, 5 years. There was no school-based support for no school-based mental health support when we were kids. Nothing. So for 5 years, she was deteriorating the way Dr. Schultz talks about. And finally, at 19, she had a major psychotic break and was hospitalized and then diagnosed as schizophrenia. If only at 14 or 15, I had come forward, my other sister had come forward, if only there weren't this stigma, if only there weren't this hidden fear. My sister, who is now 64, would not have had a life as a vegetable. She's one of those people at the end of the schizophrenic syndrome who never really was able to do much of anything. But for 5 years, she never got any support. So, unfortunately, I also had a brother who, as a teen, started drinking beer and had underlying depression. It was really clear again to me as the older brother that he was self-medicating with beer and alcohol. But again, no support in the schools. They looked at the chemical dependency, sure, they look at that, but nothing about the depression. Didn't want to acknowledge it. My mother didn't want to acknowledge it. After all, it's been historically a scarlet letter for families to bear. And we didn't deserve it. We didn't deserve it. We still don't deserve it. And my brother later committed suicide. So what you're doing today, which is looking at a bill for case management services, for school link mental health services, for parent support outreach, for crisis service for kids, good for you. How vitally important they are. We know that early intervention is the key to living successfully with a mental illness. Addressing symptoms in the school setting as soon as they present is the best way to prevent future problems. School offers kids the first interaction they really have, and they need to navigate on their own. And if we have mental health professionals in the schools, and we do have them in a smattering of schools, as I said, we served 1,000 kids last year. But there's some school districts we don't have any at all. I met with the superintendent of schools in Anoka Hennepin. He's got zero support. Why Anoka Hennepin? But there are other parts of the state that get nothing. And yet certain catchment areas have figured out how to get support because we've only had this much. So there were no mental health professionals in my sister's junior high school. There were none in my brother's, but we have an opportunity to put them in our entire system in the state of Minnesota now, rather than just piecemeal here and there.
Mr. Burkett, I thank you very much. I don't know if you have much more. We kind of have to finish up.
I
feel terrible asking you that.
I'll just end up by saying that the bills you guys are introducing today will both save money and save lives. Early identification and treatment of diabetes has proven a very successful tactic in arresting a disease in its incipiency. We can do the same in regard to depression. We can do the same in regard to anxiety disorder. We can guard the same in regard to bipolar and prevent tragedy after tragedy. And also, we can prevent people from taking on careers as disabled, mentally ill people. We don't need to have those careers anymore. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Patrick Coyne, and please stay around if you can, Mr. Burkett. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Coyne, and I'm the Director of Dakota County Social Services, and I'm representing the Children's Committee of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, known as MACSA. First, I want to commend the authors of these bills for addressing the many issues that the counties also find that we would give the willing support to. I think Mr. Burkett just pretty much spoke to eloquently the need for these services, and we at the county see these same needs. The bills that speak to parent support outreach, expansion of Children Without Crisis Team, school link being services, changing the MA benefit set for clinical consultation coordination, all of these, all the various things in these bills, frankly, the counties would support. We do have a very specific concern about the parts of this bill with reference to case management services. So I'd like to give a little bit of just a little bit of background on what that's about. So targeted case management, whether you're a child or adult, is not a direct therapy service, but a service that assists people in attaining appropriate services to meet their mental health needs. This is what's mandated for the counties to provide, and we, under the rules, Rule 79, we are in a sense the coordinators of these mental health services by statute. So, in these case management services, we coordinate the services, we make referrals, we assist people with the barriers to services like transportation, lack of insurance, and ensuring the services are being delivered appropriately. And that's a big piece that, you know, after we do these plans, that actually it's making a difference. And that we ultimately are paying for some of the, if the client is uninsured or has inadequate coverage, the counties are responsible once the plan has been approved to provide the services. So we do create safety plans, we create service plans, and we have resources on hand for both the ongoing basis and for families who are in crisis. The Children's Mental Health Service is predicated on parents still having responsibility for the children's care and supervision, and that is a key. The Adult Services-based services is based on maximizing independent living and the appropriate perspective that creates a whole different portfolio of services than the children's world. For example, medication, monitoring, housing, supports, employment, budgeting, things that will assist the adult to be successful in the adult world. We have staff who are experts in these services, but they are adult mental health case managers. The statute already allows these youth to transition into the adult mental health system, and additional language in this area is not necessary to allow continued support. So we have some concerns about the legislation that would treat adults within a case management system designed and operated based on the needs and rights of juveniles. So currently, to serve a young adult up to age 21, they have to have been served in the children's mental health system when they turn 18. We have spoken to the author and understand this qualification would be the same for this proposal. We would appreciate that the language be clear on this issue, because without clarity, there is the potential that you are opening up an entirely new population to the counties to serve, and that is a broader issue that would require a much more deeper assessment. The language currently in the draft indicates that services must continue past age 18 if requested by a child or the child's family. The ability for a family to request services to continue when the adult may have a different choice is not even, frankly, legal, and we do not ordinarily take choice away from adults without a court process. Since these clients are adults, we want to ensure that they are in charge of their own care to enhance independence and self-direction of the services they receive. So we acknowledge that there are differences in the eligibility criteria between children's mental health and adult mental health. For example, there are up to 50 diagnoses that qualify a child for children's mental health target case management. Conversely, to qualify for adult case management, a person must be seriously and persistently mentally ill. There are approximately 6 to 8 diagnoses that qualify a person for that significant, and it's a very significant diagnosis. And so as a result, we have many children's mental health clients that age out of the system at age 21 and may qualify for transitional services, but they do not qualify for ongoing adult mental health services. If we were to mandate mental health case management services for young adults ages 21 to 26 who are not seriously and persistently mentally ill, additional funding will need to be dedicated. The differences in eligibility criteria do create a gap in access. We see the gap in the system and agree that it creates issues for young adults who are not seriously and persistently mentally ill. This language puts the county as the only part responsible for this gap. Changing the system of service for the adult mental health is a broader issue, and that requires more collaboration and entities beyond the counties. In closing, the counties agree with the many services proposed in this bill, and we want to move forward on those services that we agree are in the best interest of children and their families. It is important to focus on preventive best interests of children and their families. It is important to focus on preventive services, and we feel this bill does so in supporting parent support outreach, school link-based health services, and many important training aspects of this bill. We have questions around the expansion of case management from 21 to 26 and feel that more work needs to be done on this issue before moving forward. We'd be happy to work with the department and the author of these bills, but we also need the legislature to consider the financial implications of this bill and the fiscal note for the uncompensated and undercompensated care that will come with this population. And so we just want to assert that MACSA really wants to be part of the solution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Coyne. And this is going to Representative Mullery's committee and then to Health and Human Services Finance. So we appreciate your comments, and we will definitely keep these issues in mind and work with you and hope to get this all squared away. And did I see a hand over here? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify either for or against? Well, these bills aren't actually before us. I should say, is there anyone who wants to comment on these topics before we move the bills and start doing that? Okay. Seeing none. All right. Representative Davney. So, members, there is a significant amount of, there is overlap among some of these bills. And Representative Davney's bill has overlap both in the bill that I'm carrying and in the one that Representative Lane is carrying. So, Representative Davney, I thought I'd give you the first opportunity.
Madam Chair.
And
Can I move the bill?
Absolutely. Thank Representative you. Abler. Representative Abler moves House File 353, and the motion is that House File 353 be recommended. Is that the one? Yeah. House File 353 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. So welcome to the committee, Representative Davney. I don't know if you had a chance to hear all of the discussion that we've had, but we have gotten quite a bit of background on this whole topic area, and it's in particular on the school-linked mental health part of this. So if you want to just briefly give us a bit of background on your bill, and our intention is to move these all out to Representative Mullery's committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Abler. Yes, Madam Chair, I was able to be here for most of the hearing, and obviously am not up to providing the base that the mental health professionals and families were able to provide for you already. Just a few quick comments. Currently, school-based mental health grants only are available, or school-based mental health practitioners are only available in 17% of the schools across our state, 65 of Minnesota's 87 counties. So we've got significant gaps then in the availability of mental health services and access to mental health professionals for the students in our state today. The House File 353 would provide additional funding to improve that and improve access to students and their families to mental health services in the schools. Specifically, the bill emphasizes having 25% of those grants go to settings where And I lost my train of thought. Where there's significant percentages of students identified as having emotional and behavioral disorders, high poverty, or settings where there's a significant use of prone restraint, an area that I have carried bills in the past and will be again this year. I want to hone in just very briefly on one dimension of this, Madam Chair, and that is to remind members of this committee that Minnesota has the second largest achievement gap in the country. And members may think it odd that I bring that up before a Health and Human Services Committee, although I do note that a number of members here do also serve on one or both of the education committees. But I bring that up because I believe the achievement gap is actually the quantification of a number of other gaps in our communities. A gap in housing, a gap in employment opportunities for parents, a gap in prenatal care for moms before these children were born, a gap in educational opportunities, and yes, also a gap in access to mental health services. the Eden Prairie School District testified before the Education Policy Committee, and they see in the school-based mental health services that they provide there improved attendance on the part of children receiving those services, decreased referrals to special education services, significant state savings in that, and importantly, 94% of the students receiving school-based mental health services in the Eden Prairie District show improved academic achievement. I would argue then that the need to close the achievement gap is urgent. The opportunity and to do that spans across committees, including to this one, as well as the committee that this bill is being referred to. I appreciate the committee's time and attention today and the opportunity to work on this issue.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Are there questions for Representative Dabney? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, you mentioned in just a previous comment that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm 17%, a factor of 17% have access to consultative services. Am I correct in that?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, from the information I've received, the current school-based mental health grants go to 17% of the schools in the state in 65 of our 87 counties.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, would you characterize those as being in greater Minnesota or the metro area?
Representative Dabney.
Yes. if it pleases the chair, I do have a map of the state by county where these services are provided. If I could give it to one of the pages and they make copies, I'd be glad to provide that. As one of the previous testifiers from People Incorporated noted, Anoka-Hennepin, the largest school district in the state, does not benefit from these grants at this time. That, even though within the past several years, the Department of Health has identified that school district as a site of contagion for suicidal action on the part of students. There's a metro county that does not have access to this. There's a number of rural counties that do, a number that do not.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, I'm new to this, and so I'm just going to are there programs with results that we're modeling this after?
Madam Chair, can I phone a friend?
Please, Representative Dabney.
Ring, ring.
Ms. Abner Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, there has been a movement nationwide to develop school-based or school-linked mental health services. We've had this since 2008. It was passed in 2007, and we've kept really good data on it, which is in that Mental Health Legislative Network booklet. Some of the data is in there. Yes. So we've been able to actually track the data about our kids improving, you know, all of those kinds of things, suspension rates, all of it. And I might add that nationwide, they actually look to the Minnesota model because the way we set it up, it's the mental health providers coming in. It's not the school taking on the responsibility of treatment, which we don't think that's the school's role. And so we've been able to separate out the healthcare records from the educational records. So we have, you know, HIPAA compliance. You don't have to worry about it being a school record. And because it's a mental health provider, they also bill private insurance, medical assistance, and Minnesota Care.
Madam Chair, may I have one just follow-up, please?
Yeah, Representative Albright.
Thank you. Could you describe, then, the types of services that would be intentioned to be supported in the school?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a number of things. It can be individual therapy. It can be group therapy. It can be skills training. What am I missing? I mean, there's a family therapy, so it can be a broad range of services and supports.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Dabney.
Just take it one more step. An added value to having the mental health professional in the school is not only the services that they're able to provide that Ms. Abderholden identified and the ease of access because they're embedded there in the school and the community, but the school-based mental health grants also support their interactions with school personnel that insurance will not. So they're able to consult with classroom teachers and other staff in the building on Johnny and what Johnny's situation is, behaviors, treatment, how the staff can be supportive. It provides a stronger context for the student and the family then, as well as greater access.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Aberholden or Representative Dabney, are you looking for like a mental health specialist in every school? Or how many schools are you looking at? And if so, what would the revenue stream be for this? And how would it be funded?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, what I can identify is the governor's recommendation is for $7.43 million in grants over the upcoming biennium, $2.52 million in fiscal year 14, and $4.9 million in fiscal year 15.
As in addition to the base.
Yes, and that is on top of the existing base. It would not fund a mental health professional in each school in the state.
Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you for that. Do you know, or Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, do you know exactly how that would be broken down throughout the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, because these are grants, what happens is the mental health providers actually apply for them in collaboration with their schools. So, and of course they have to get the collaboration piece because the schools, you know, don't want to work with them, that it obviously is not going to work. And, you know, then their grants are evaluated and the money is provided. So we've had pretty good luck in terms of looking at statewide. We have some pockets, you know, where we don't have services. And sometimes it was because the money ran out. There wasn't enough money to provide. And other times it was because someone did not apply.
Yeah, thank you. Other questions, members? And what I'd like to do, I see we've got Representative Lomer on the list. Let me just say, though, this bill has just this one provision. We've got Representative Lane waiting. Hers has this in it in addition mm-hmm. to other pieces. So if we can take the question from Representative Lomer, let's vote on this bill. Representative Dabney can be done, and then hopefully we can have Representative Lane present her bill before we recess. Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was really almost the same as Representative Franzen's, but I guess maybe I'll just follow up by asking, you mentioned $7.43 million that the governor asked for, so will the fiscal note be of that same amount? Have you asked for one of those?
Representative Dabney?
Madam Chair, Representative Lomer, if you look at House File 353, the appropriation amounts are left blank. That will be for the determination of future committees to the HHS policy, excuse me, Finance Committee, to determine how much to place into this program.
Right. Representative Lomer, I think the idea is that these bills eventually will be in the HHS Finance Committee, and decisions will have to be made about which pieces have priority and which can be mm-hmm. funded and at what amount. So that will happen in a different place. Thank you, though. Are there other questions before we vote on Representative Dabney's bill? If not, Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 353 be recommended to pass recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill
Thank
is
you, Madam
passed.
Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Members, we're going to continue for 15 more minutes here before we recess, and we will come back at 6 o'clock in this room and to finish up this evening. And hopefully we can move somewhat quickly because we've covered the policy with our earlier discussion, which is not to say that members shouldn't feel free to ask questions that they need to ask. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Need somebody to move?
Yes.
I will see. Representative Loeffler.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'd like to move Representative Lane's bill with the recommend to pass and to be referred to the Committee on Early Child and Youth Development. That would be House File 359.
Yes. Representative Loeffler moves that House File 359 be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill has four parts. You've heard a little bit about a couple of them already. The first section is about when youth are transitioning out at 18. It's a difficult time in anybody's life, not just when you also have a diagnosis of mental illness. But there's nothing magical about age 18. And at this time, they're struggling with employment, possibility of education, housing. So to allow them the possibility of, at their request or their family's request, to stay with their children's case manager until they choose to leave or until they reach age 26, one of the things that does, I think, is it ensures that they have some health insurance, which is very crucial for some of the treatment. So this, I have been spoken to by some of the county people concerned about perhaps redefining what is child services and what are adult, but that's perhaps something that can be taken up in the next committee. So that's the first part, is not just having it end at age 18. And Section 2 speaks to a small building in Willmar that houses the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, and it's been our state's safety net to for children with very high needs, more violent and difficult behaviors. It's been very small, houses at the most 14 kids, so it's time to look at this program and see if it's the best use of our resources. This allows the commissioner to develop a group to look at recommendations and legislation regarding this use. Section 3 relates to something called psychiatric residential treatment centers, which I believe we don't have in Minnesota. And it's a very intensive level of care for children and adolescents with severe emotional disturbances, very complex mental health disorders, multiple diagnoses, violent behaviors. They're currently sent out of state or housed in detention facilities. And this looks to having a work group to develop standards for developing, for establishing these psychiatric residential treatment centers in the state, and it would require state and federal approval to allow a level of care in the MA benefit set. So that's another work group. And then Section 4 has some appropriations, and it includes five pieces. One is crisis teams in every county to be able to effectively divert children in mental illnesses from being hospitalized to be able to step in at the time of need. Section 2 speaks to mental health first aid, what to do in a crisis. Helps that we will train some people, and these people will train others. And this provision is actually in President Obama's proposal to reduce gun violence, to get more people aware of how to do mental health first aid. And Section 3 regards the respite care to help families recharge when they are in just exhausted by the things they do. And Section 4 gives a training for community health workers to address health care and mental health care disparities. And then Section 5 is related to the school-linked mental health grants that Representative Dabney was speaking of. So it allows, and it passed in 2007 bipartisanly and has been working to have collaboration with the schools and the services as he recommended. And this, as he said, is not sufficient. We need more to do this across the state. So with that, members, that's the sections of this bill.
Are there questions for Representative Lane? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that Representative Lane and Ms. Abderholden and the MAXA group will keep working on, you know, how to work with this, because I totally believe in us getting into early ID and getting kids services early. But we know if we identify more kids, they'll have more kids transitioning into an adult system that isn't really prepared to help them transition. And we need to figure out how to put that together, because whenever we've done enlargement of one part of the system and then there's no one to hand it off to, it just doesn't work. It's sort of, I mean, I feel really bad for some of our people who have done really good intensive services in special ed, And you know, that's not the same as mental health, but they graduate with such high expectations for their life, and then they get put on waiting lists and can't move on and get stalled out. And I just don't want to see that happening to this population by design. And so I really encourage you to keep the dialogue going.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, out of curiosity, in Section 2, what obviously, or I shouldn't say obviously, but it seems like there must be some direction or thought as to what you're thinking or someone's thinking we should do in Willmar related to that facility, which is a facility I'm aware of, and I know that they're certainly understaffed, and they do house some of the most dangerous kids that are, you know, like you said, our safety net. What's your intention? Why? What was sparked here, and what direction are you thinking this needs to go?
Madam Chair, Representative,
Ms. Holden.
We know that they have a problem recruiting sometimes highly qualified people, very experienced in working with kids like this. We know that some of these children have medical issues. So it really is, I don't have a preconceived idea other than, you know, if you have a loved one who has a very kind of rare illness or very serious illness, typically you think you're going to go to Rochester or the Twin Cities. Because that's where you tend to have more of the specialists. But what we really want to do is bring everyone together, because that really hasn't happened, and bring everyone together to say, okay, so what are the needs? Is this really what the safety net should be, or are there community providers that can provide that kind of safety net? And if you look on especially lines 211 to 213, we're talking about kids who may have a mental illness and a developmental disability, borderline personality disorder, you know, early onset schizophrenia. And so we just haven't had that discussion. And we want to make sure that we're using all our resources as effectively as possible. If they're only able to serve that many children because of the staffing, then we need to look at, so what do we do with the rest of the kids that are waiting? So I'm not saying that, oh yeah, it'll definitely move to the Twin Cities or something like that, but I think we need to look at what do the kids across the state need. And about half of the kids right now that have been in that facility are from the Twin Cities as well.
Okay, seeing no other questions, I think we're ready to vote on Representative Lane's bill. So Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 359 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill passes. Thank you, Representative Lane. And members, just we're going to recess and to the call of the chair, which will be at 6 o'clock in this room. And hopefully, I apologize for that, members. I do think we're still learning the management pieces of this, and we perhaps bit off a little more than we could, than we should have for this. These very short, we have really very few hours in this committee. But before we do, I just want to make a couple of comments, members, if you would just give me a second. First of all, I just want to announce to the members of this committee that we're going to waive the 24-hour rule in view of the changes to the permanent rules. So we will not be having a 24-hour rule in this committee, and I trust that members will not abuse that they'll do real work in the committee and not just have amendments to delay anything or, you know, for other purposes. But I really do want members to be able to have impact on the policy that we're doing in this committee. It's so important, as we saw today. These pieces are very important. The other thing I want members to know is tomorrow's hearing, which is our infant day in this committee, we're going to be hearing Representative Fritz's bill about child sleeping in child care. And I want to just notify members that we are not going into the broad scope of either the mortality report or child or licensing in child care. We're going to be very limited in this committee. We're going to hear a little overview just to frame the issue, but we're really going to focus on the sleep issue. And I just want members to know that, because other issues will be handled in Representative Mullery's committee. So if there are the more broad licensing issues for child care, I just want to let members know that, so that we can kind of keep our discussion here within that scope. Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Could you just explain how we're going to separate
the sleeping issue itself from the mortality report and from SIDS? Because in my opinion, you can't.
Well, Representative Franson, I appreciate that. And we may not be able to do it entirely, but what I'm trying to say is that there are different recommendations that may be coming from the department for various things coming out of that report, like additional training and things like that. And that we're not going to be dealing with those issues in this committee. We're going to really try to stick to what the report says that may result in the recommendation that's coming forward from Representative Fritz. So I'm not saying we're going to ignore the report. I just don't want us to be discussing the whole report because all of it isn't relevant here. But whatever you do find relevant to that issue, we'll certainly discuss. Representative Franson.
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. Because if I recall from reading the bill, we're simply saying that the parent can no longer write a note on the sleeping position, but the parent now has to go to the doctor. Is that correct, Madam Fritz?
Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair. This is a bill I had 6 years ago before the mortality survey or study, and it specifies that a parent will have to get a doctor's slip in order to have the child care provider place the infant in any sleeping position other than its back, period. And that's been right. In statute, that's the law, the pediatrics and all the docs and all the nurses and all the providers believe that.
Right.
That is the position.
Right.
And so that's the bill, period.
Yeah. Representative Fritz, and I don't want to get into discussion of that bill now because we will do that tomorrow.
We don't want to ruin the suspense.
Yeah, I did. Right. But I did just want to let members know so that as you prepare for tomorrow that you know that we're not going to, we'll hear a little bit about the report, but I just don't want people to worry that we're going to start going into the other recommendations. We're going to keep it pretty narrowly on this. Representative
Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank you for waiving that 24-hour rule and giving us a chance
You're
to
welcome.
Participate. I sincerely appreciate it. Okay.
Okay, and we are in recess to 6 o'clock this evening. Committee will come to order. We have Representative Loeffler's bill. Representative Loeffler, would you like to move your bill? Get it before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 358 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler moves that House File 358 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. And Representative Loeffler, you have a couple of author's amendments.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I have two of them, and I'd like to first move the H0358A2 amendment, which is just technical wording changes to make it more consistent through the language, and we appreciate the work of House Research in developing that.
All right. Well, we'll just, we have these two author's amendments to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like it, and the first is the A2, so we'll adopt those, and then you can discuss the whole bill. So all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And then I would next move the H0358A3 amendment.
Okay.
And that provides some, I think, clear language on the pilot provider input survey, and I'll be glad to explain that once it's adopted.
Okay. Representative Loeffler moves the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which she'd like to discuss it. All those in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the A3 is adopted. So, Representative Loeffler, we have your bill before us in the shape in which you want to discuss it. So,
thank you, Madam Chair and members. This morning we heard in testimony about the many gaps that in our current service system for children with mental health issues. And this bill steps forward to fill in some of those gaps and to create a more coordinated and cost-effective care system to meet their needs. And I think in some ways it kind of models some of the discussion we've had in committee about the healthcare home, where you try and have people work to their appropriate license and to surround people with the kind of supports that will actually enable success through the transitions. Section 1 just clarifies that school districts are not liable for paying for mental health services. You've heard about the need to separate those and why that's advantageous earlier today. Section 2 is really kind of a different provision, but I think it's important, and it would provide for a pilot provider survey to assess the efficiency and operational issues in the management of the healthcare delivery system. We have often heard that a variety of providers come to us with problems that seem to make their operations much less efficient and effective in dealing with multiple health providers and confusing regulations. And this would just say that the Commissioner of Human Services should initiate a provider survey, starting with a pilot focused on children's mental health providers and their support systems. Electronic survey, asking them about key issues related to the development and authorization and billing for those services, providing input to the commissioner that we think will be useful for her as she designs the fee-for-service system and it's hires contractors to manage that, as well as providing input into the managed care system. I've designed it as a pilot project that I would hope that if it's successful would go to other provider groups on perhaps a rotating business. And it is a model that has been used by CMS with Medicare. There are already electronic communications between the providers and DHS, and we think it can be done fairly cost-effectively and help in our quality improvement system as we move forward. The rest of the bill deals more with new mental health services that I think will better support children moving forward. Section 3 provides support for a training and certification to families to be family peer specialists. Families dealing with the types of issues that we heard about earlier today are often overwhelmed, feel like they're the only person who has this, can't imagine where to go. And in other service systems, we've used peer counselors and peer support systems, trained parent advocates, and that model we think could work very well with this population. And so it gives the outlines of what would need to be developed to implement that. The family psychoeducation would support the provider's time spending time with families. Children with mental health issues don't exist on their own. They exist within a family situation. We heard earlier today about how it affects other children in the household in addition to the strains that it puts on the parents. And this would allow time to be spent with the families on how to better work with that child and how to create a supportive environment for everyone within that household in order to support recovery. Section 6 provides for clinical care consultation, which will allow mental health professionals to bill for the time spent consulting with other professionals. One of the big barriers that we have is we always say we want coordinated care, but then if we don't authorize that, any kind of reimbursement for that, it doesn't tend to happen. Children need to have the people they're interacting with at the schools, in the physical health system, and other supports to have a chance to talk together and do shared treatment planning so that there's consistency in the approach to that child and their family. And then Section 7 defines care coordination assessment within the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports Package. And provides for care coordination time to, again, be a recognized services within medical assistance. And Section 8 is just allows us to request these be covered by medical assistance so that we can earn the federal reimbursement rate. And so that's just a really quick overview of the contents, but the overall goal is to try and blend a variety of support services that will be affordable, cost-effective, and provide maybe some better supports for families who are in transition and need more attention than perhaps we can let be billable by a very highly skilled mental health practitioner when a peer support of another parent might be able to address some of those needs. And with me I have Mary Reagan, who would be glad to help answer questions, and I look forward to the discussion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And there is an amendment now. I don't know if, well, first of all, do members have any questions to the bill so far? Okay, well then,
Madam Chair,
we'll take the amendment if it's off.
Just to the bills.
Yes. Representative,
I don't know if the department's here, but I just, are they working? I like where we're going with this, and it's certainly a good year to do this, and I was just thinking this may be one of the hallmarks of our term here, of that we, a session that we could get some of this put together. And I don't care if they testify now, but it's going to go to some more committees. But is the department engaged in this, or is NAMI just working on some things, or do you know that? Or maybe the author knows, or you have one of the bills too, so I'll ask you.
Right. Well, Representative Abler, I think that some of it is actually kind of crosses over with some of what the department is doing, but probably not all. And I don't really know the complete answer to your question. I don't know if anybody from DHS is here that can answer, but this is going to another committee, and yeah, will be another policy committee, so there will be more opportunity to engage. And then, of course, as I explained earlier, in the finance committee, it'll be worked on again and put together as a package. So, I don't think there is anybody here. I'm not seeing anybody,
Madam
from
Chair.
DHS. Representative,
I have no problem with works in progress. I think that's the beauty of our system, especially when you have multiple committees where things can move between and people are exposed, and you know, so I think we're on the right track.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think on this particular bill, we sort of do have that luxury because we have the second policy committee that has more or less the same jurisdiction over this as we do. So in this one case, I think we can afford to use a placeholder system, Representative Abler. So, Representative Abler, is this your amendment, and do you want to move it?
Sure. I'd like to move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Abler moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to explain your amendment?
No, just adopt it. Yeah, I'll be happy to explain it. This is a bit of a project, and I thank the chair for being willing to entertain it. I mean, the author and a few of the people in the room still. It's a much smaller crowd than this afternoon. It's in keeping with actually some of the themes of the bill. Anoka has suffered at least 8 suicides in too short a time. And I don't want a 9th. And I don't know, understand. I'm learning quite a bit even about some of the day-to-day stuff they're doing there. They've hired some mental health staff, and they have a ways to go, it sounds like. But so the whole thing kind of provokes me on this. If you recall, we created Representative Cascaden, or Senator Cascaden, and I created the licensed professional counselor along with some help from many people. And they were deemed to be not high enough of a credential, I think, in the 2007 task force or whenever it was. And so we created another level of licensure, the LPCC, Licensed Professional Clinical Counselor. And some of these LPCs are school counselors and other kinds of mid-level counselors, not usually compensable under medical assistance. And this amendment as written is not ready to become law, but it's provoking a discussion. This is the bill is being introduced tomorrow. It's going to go to Representative Mariani's committee. And he has an interest in creating some other interesting levels of service. And then this will also come back to finance when it's done. And my commitment to all the interested parties, which are several, is that if this just doesn't work, we're not going to do it. But my idea is this, is if, you know, LPCCs working, we have one in our school district now overseeing some mental health stuff. And so if there's a way to use them as an extension of their services, much as what this bill is doing, it might give us some more boots on the ground, paid with medical assistance instead of school funding. And I don't know what the targets are going to be. I haven't x-rayed Representative Huntley's head yet about what his mental health intentions are, and I'm not going to question his motives, only to urge him to spend some money here. But who knows how the dust all settles, what our target will be. And so I'm trying to have a multiple track way to get some more help for the students in schools. And I tried to write it narrowly. The concept is correct, that we'd somehow compensate these individuals or other similar ones as we get through Representative Mariani's committee. When they're under supervision of a person who has a high credential, and they would have a relatively short leash, I would think, on these individuals, what they'd be allowed to do there. And some are very capable and some aren't capable at all. And I think that the mental health professional would decide, or the Yeah, the mental health professional would decide who he would trust to work with this. So with that, I'd appreciate members putting it on, and I will work with this. And I raised both hands talking to one of the interested parties to attest that I would make sure that they sign off before I push this anywhere.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to hear, you know, from anyone else who'd like to comment on it. I was honest with Representative Abler that I'm not an expert on mental health licensing issues and levels of care, and I would want to make sure that it really fits within the rest. And there are some data privacy issues that, you know, by having the mental health services separate from the school that keeps it off of kids' permanent school records and things like that, that would also need to be addressed. So it's an idea that needs some thought. And, you know, so I'm not going to take a position against it, but I do think there are some concerns that need to be addressed for me to support it in the final version.
Okay, and I have a few questions for Representative Abler. So, Representative Abler, is your intention here, the way this is drafted, it looks like basically you're just getting some funding to some people. And so I'm wondering, is your intention to have more of these people on the ground because they would be funded, or to have them supervised by a licensed professional? I'm just not sure how just adding funding for them really accomplishes anything. So maybe you could
let me explain what I've learned. When you write an amendment up, then people, and you pass it on, people start talking. So this is as drafted. If I had written an amendment to the amendment, it would be another paragraph longer at least. But it's one of these works in progress, Madam Chair. But I believe at this point it would be it would not be hired by the school district. These people, because there's FERPA, which is a privacy thing with mental health, and if a school counselor recognizes that you have schizophrenia, that has to go on your record and it follows you forever. If a mental health professional that you're seeing that's not a school employee recognizes that, it goes into your private health record. And so already I've learned that, and so I thought, why couldn't they just hire these people? But I'd like them to be in the school, much like what we're doing with our grants we talked about earlier today. And the school would then provide space, perhaps, which I think we may embellish that in the education committee about how they would even provide that as just for free or a deal or something. But I'd like it to be on the site so they could come and go. But so then it wouldn't be subject to any educational privacy issues. And then much like some of the like one of the witnesses right at the table, Madam Chair, works in this niche, but it's meant to give them more capacity, because we hear there's not enough counselors in schools. School budgets are not going to be real rich, I think, at the end of this session in terms of any big increases. I don't think we're going to go home with $3.7 billion, maybe approaching half of that. Which means districts like Anoka will be lean again, and adding people on the ground is going to be challenging. And so at least this money becomes two for one. We pay a dollar, get $2 for the service. They're a relatively lower cost, and it would be a way to extend the services that are available. And I believe more things will evolve by the time it gets back to the Health Finance Committee.
Representative Abler, the other thing that a little bit concerns me about this is whether this would send the bill to civil law because of the privacy data issues. I don't know enough about that. Representative Loeffler, would you have any concern about that?
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative
it's a freestanding bill, so if it has to go there, I'll take it there as a in the with a vehicle. It's going to wind up where this bill is going to wind up anyway. So if I have to go there, I'll go there. And it's going to education policy first.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. Well, you know, there is a question about whether if it's a freestanding bill and it's already, you've got a commitment from the Education Committee, you know, does it need to be added here? I mean, I think it's, for us, the issue is can we build a system for kids that's as cost-effective as possible but surrounds them with the services that are needed to keep them out of hospitalization and high-end services and catch things early before they decompress. And to me, the more that we have all those pieces kind of knit together, I don't think there's anything in this bill or Representative Lane's bill that would prohibit any of, or Representative Dabney's bill that would prohibit someone who got a school-based grant that we've discussed earlier this morning from utilizing someone with this licensure as part of their care team. My hesitancy is about highlighting one level of licensure when some of these kids clearly need much higher level intensive services, and to just have it floating separate and not integrated within that school mental health clinic, you know, teamwork, but rather be about a license rather than about a mental health provider team is my only concern. Is that because I just feel, and on the data privacy issue, I think you can, your bill doesn't, your amendment and your bill assume does not require that they be school district employees, so that can change things. It just says they can practice in a school, but once again, are they affiliated with someone who can bill and who will coordinate with the other services that we're putting here, including case management? I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
The intent is to have this coordinate with everything. We're sending four bills out of here, some of which are identical with each other, which have blanks in them. And I think if there's a topic for today's hearing, it's cool ways to help kids get mental health services in and around a school. And this is certainly compatible with that. So, I mean, if the committee would trust me to do this, it just satisfies a need. But this has to be here at all, and so then it's been duly heard here, and it just moves it along. And my word has been, and I presume your word also on the bills I'm moving out of here, voting to move out, that you will also get these all coordinated, and there'll be some kind of coherent plan. This may actually be an important part of that. So if that's my request.
Okay. Well, Representative Abler, my preference would be to have it be at least three quarters baked by the time it goes in a bill. But as I noted and we've been discussing with these particular bills, they do have another stop and finance, and probably none of them will end up on the floor just the way it is right now. So I think for me, I guess with your commitment that's kind of what we're doing here, I would be okay with putting it on. Representative Loeffler, do you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm, you know, welcome to have it float along with my bill. But I do think we need to, as it evolves, just sort of figure out how it fits with all the other pieces. And sure. I don't pretend to know exactly how these different licenses work together.
Okay. Madam Chair, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, let's vote on that then. So Representative Abler renews his motion to for the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Loeffler, are there any other questions? Any discussion of the bill? Representative Schumacher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I missed the part about Section 1. They're on the first page, lines 1.14 and 1.15. Could you please explain that again for me,
sure,
just briefly?
That just clarifies that school districts aren't liable for paying for mental health services if they refer someone. So the concept is that if, you know, a teacher identifies someone who they think might need some, should be evaluated, that by just making the referral, that not doesn't create a financial obligation on the school district to pay for those services. You just don't want that chilling effect.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, this is a very interesting topic for me, and some of this is really coming at me from a perspective of definitions. So one of the ideas that you presented is a mental health certified family peer specialist program. And I'm just wondering if that originated someplace else, if we're modeling that idea or definition after something that's already been in place, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. I'll let one of our witnesses come up here. I think that I'm familiar with that kind of an approach being used in other areas. I'm not sure that it has been used in this area in Minnesota, but I'll let Sue Abderholden give you a better background on it.
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have adult peer specialists in our adult mental health system, and we've never had children's family peer specialists, but it is done in about 15 states across the country, and there's actually a national curriculum for out of the Federation for Families, so they do train the families. I mean, they need to understand data practices laws, you know, how to actually help a parent kind of get through, frankly, their grief over, you know, their child having this illness, and then learn how the different laws and things work in Minnesota. It's been very helpful in other states. I've talked to the folks in Tennessee as one example. We've done a tiny piece of it through a contract that we actually have with Dakota County, where we've trained parents to be experienced parents. So they've been through, you know, they have a kid with a serious mental illness, and then they actually have helped those families figure out, so what services do I get, and we have collected some data on it and showed that their stress levels went down. They knew that they had someone to call when they were feeling, you know, really at their wit's end. Some families have actually, some of our experienced parents have accompanied a family to an IEP team meeting where they weren't sure what to do. So it's just kind of a helpful thing, and since we have workforce shortages, this is also another way to help with CTSS providers so that they can hire these family peer specialists. But we wanted it to be kind of more patterned on the adult peer specialists and these programs that are existing in other states that they have allowed Medicaid reimbursement for.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. I just have a couple of definitions, if you'll indulge me, since they are new to me, and I suspect that they might be new to other people. But if you could just define for me clinical care coordination, family psychoeducation, and mental health clinical care coordination.
Representative Laughlin. Ms. Hagan.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I'll do my best. So mental health clinical care consultation is about a professional-to-professional consultation. So, for example, if a mental health professional, these are independent mental health professionals, so they have to have the highest license in the different categories, were to consult with the child's pediatrician, for example. That would be called clinical care consultation. So it's professional-to-professional and related to the care that the two professionals are providing to the child.
Madam Chair, you mentioned consultation. Are you using that in the same vernacular as coordination?
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I believe that the I'm looking on page 4 at 4.31, and that is the benefit that we're, I believe, talking about in this bill, and that's what it's called. And it really is about consulting, two professionals consulting with each other in the best interests of the care of the child. And then we have care coordination, which is a separate service, and this is something that could be done between the individuals working with the child and other collateral people, the school, the teacher, other practitioners. So it's more about coordinating the care that they're providing in a way that will assist the child and the family to have everybody on the same page, as was said earlier. It's not a clinical consultation that about the treatment in the same way that the clinical consultation piece is. It's about coordinating the care so that all involved, the family, the teacher, are on the same page with the child. It's a tricky distinction, but it is distinct.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're talking about this in the context of a state facilitated program, but are we envisioning that is going to be any possibility for federal funding to this program as a source?
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, all of these services would be added to our medical assistance benefit set so that they would all the state dollars would be matched by federal dollars. These are all eligible federal codes for these kinds of services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 358 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and
thank
the bill
you very
is
much.
Passed. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. All right, members, I'd like to move House File 296 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy Committee.
Okay. Representative Leland moves that House File 296 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Committee of Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. Representative Liebling, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, members, I'm definitely no expert on this area. I think it's been a very interesting day. I've actually learned a lot. And this bill that I'm carrying is one of the NAMI bills, and so I have Sue Abderholden here to give you some explanation of it. Some of this does overlap with, I think, with Representative Lane's bill and one of the other bills, and that is this case management piece, which is Section 2 of the bill. Section 1 is this exception to the formulary, which basically allows that a health plan must grant an exception to the plan's formulary. In other words, they have a specific list of drugs that they approve, and they have to make an exception for certain patients when the drug is included in a research-based protocol on treating first episode psychosis. So I'm going to ask Sue to explain that, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, members. One of the things that we've discovered is that when a young person is put on an antipsychotic for the first time, sometimes they have to, you know, do a lot of prior authorization with the health plan, and they say, no, we want you to try this one first instead of this one. And we do run into problems, and what you want to do with these young people, in particular who are having the first psychotic episode, is find that medication where they can tolerate the side effects. And there is some research that says you should use, you know, one of these three medications first. And we just, you know, we want to keep them on medication. So I have received comments and questions from the health plans. I have committed to working with them. We're going to meet next week to kind of fix the language to make sure everybody can live with it. But the whole point of it was to make sure that we're not, you know, putting people through hoops to get the medication that they will stay on that will actually treat their schizophrenia, which is, of course, the most disabling condition. And what you don't want is someone with schizophrenia not on medication. So we don't want to put them through hoops to do that.
Okay. Thank you. So, members, Section 3 is under this appropriation section, and again, we've got blank appropriations, and this is part of our plan today to move these bills through and get them to the Finance Committee ultimately, and then we'll work out what we can afford and what the most highest priority pieces of this would be. But the first one is for, well, I should just let Sue
Abderholden just explain them rather than me trying to do it. So why don't you just go ahead?
Okay, Madam Chair, members. So the Parent Support Outreach Program is a current pilot program, and it provides early intervention to families who are at significant risk from child maltreatment, which could include a serious mental illness. Subdivision 2 is really to try to create some pilot programs around treating people who have a first episode of psychosis. You know, again, this is one of those conditions that could create, could be the most disabling, and so if we can intervene the right way, I kind of liken to it, you know, you don't say to someone who has just found out they had cancer, come back when you hit stage 4 and we'll help you, but that's kind of what we do when someone has their first psychotic episode. We say, we're going to wait till you've been hospitalized numerous times, until you're unemployed, until you're homeless, and then, or maybe in a jail, and then maybe we'll treat you. And so what we want to do is make sure that, one, that the person, the young person, really understands their illness, has that psychoeducation, because, you know, self-knowledge is important, that they have a support group. One of the things that is probably puts them at risk for perhaps a violent act is when they isolate themselves, and so you want to have support groups so they can connect to another person. You want the family to have education, because none of us would have any idea what to do if we found out our kid was hallucinating, so you really need to get that education and know what to do. And a big thing is to make sure that they have something to do. None of us would get better sitting in an apartment by ourselves watching daytime TV especially, and so we need to make sure that either they go back to school and they get their diploma, or that they have a job, and so again that they're interacting with other people and they're earning money, which is a good thing too. And then the training for mental health professionals is also for healthcare professionals. A lot of folks really don't know how to identify those first kind of early symptoms and warning signs of first psychotic episode. So we want to make sure that there's some training in there so that if they, a family practitioner in greater Minnesota, has a kid that comes to them, they know what to do. So we think that's an important part, too.
And then, members, subdivision 4 here is the school-linked mental health services, which we have discussed before, and I think that's exactly the same as the other in the other bills, correct?
Yeah.
So we're open to questions.
So is there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Okay, Representative Abler.
Oh, yeah, okay, Madam Chair, and whichever of you, the county fellow came and had concerns about this. Is that just a money thing? And I'm sure you can work that through. But just what was your reaction to what he said?
We had some discussion with the counties. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yeah, could you go through the chair?
Yeah, sorry. We had some discussion with the counties earlier in the day, Representative Abler, and I know their concern has to do with how the systems fit together, because children's mental health is different from adult mental health, and the standard for what you have to, how you qualify, is different. So their concern is that if we take people who sort of age out of children's mental health and keep them on that system, that they don't necessarily apply, they don't necessarily fit the standard for the adult section, which is serious
and
persistent mental illness, and whereas it's serious emotional disorder for children. So it's a different standard, and so how we make that transition, how we fit those together, and where the funding comes from, because that affects the funding stream. So we're all committed to making this work, and we understand that we're not going to put more on the counties and ask them to absorb the funding, and they're of course worried about that, but I think we all understand that if we want them to do more, we have to give them the resources to do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Abler?
Yeah, Ms. Abderholden, maybe you can answer this for me. And so I appreciate your answer. It's a great answer. But is the problem, I mean, here's this person who becomes whatever the boundary age is, and he needed help yesterday, and tomorrow he doesn't qualify but he's still not all right. And so is the problem the definition? And the way to do continuity, and maybe you're on to exactly the right thing, and maybe the names are all wrong, and so we raised the bar, so they're like, they're not so good here, but now I have to be really bad, and so in the meantime, we have to wait till it gets really bad. Is that the gap that we're addressing? And I like it if that's the right answer. So,
Ms. Alden Holden?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, it's a little of both. So we do have some kids that would drop off at 18 because they don't meet the adult standard, but clearly they've been in the children's mental health system, and it's not easy to get into the children's mental health system, so we know that they have, you know, a serious illness. And then for some, they would qualify for the adult, but we're making change, you know, who they even work with, just because they hit 18. And that is such a critical time if they're leaving school, you know, moving on to the next phase of their life, to all of a sudden shift all of that as well is really difficult. So we want to try to make that smooth transition so that, you know, they're moving into the adult system, you know, whether they're going off their parents' insurance or, you know, if they are going to look at housing. I mean, I do really think that a lot of this was written, 18 was different when I was 18. I think anyone here who has kids know that it is different. You know, they're coming back to live at home with you, and they're 21 and 22. You know, I only called my parents, you know, on a Sunday afternoon for 5 minutes because it was long distance, and, you know, my kids call and text me all the time now. It's a different standard. We don't expect 18-year-olds necessarily to leave the house and be fully independent like we did when I was 18. So I think we need to also look at that a little differently. And you have kids who are generally not even emotionally, you know, the same as another 18-year-old because they've had the serious illness, which has disrupted, you know, their ability to socialize and take care of themselves.
Madam Chair, just
Representative
a comment. Just to kind of put this all in context for how I'm thinking about this. In the first year of 2011, we did all the budgeting. We did competitive bidding in the healthcare thing and Medicaid and really kind of reordered that. And Representative Huntley was in the 2008 thing. And that's been kind of worked over pretty well. And then we did some disability services management in 2012. And we never spent any time doing except just trying to preserve the mental health stuff and not have it be reduced. But I think this is really going to provoke a good dialogue. And you have a month till your deadlines and 2 months until the finance deadlines to actually do some pretty cool work. So maybe these kind of questions and this could really be the hallmark of maybe all the planets line up, you know. So and good luck to both of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Babe.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, I'm looking at the bill, and I note that there's five blank lines, but one really, really big number. And apologize for being the money guy, but from a stewardship perspective, I'm wondering if you could help me understand what the expectation is in terms of filling in those five blanks. But then, as a follow-on to that, you know, where does that $10 million number come from, and what would it be used for?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. The simple answer is, I don't know where that number came from. Maybe Ms. Abderholden does.
Mrs. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, it actually came from Senator Sharon. It's currently the base for schooling to mental health services is $4.77 million per year, and then the governor's budget increased it by almost $10 million. So it really should be a joint number, which is why, I mean, my preference is to always kind of wait putting in the numbers until you have a better idea of what's in the governor's budget and things like that. And this was put together prior to that. So I think it's an additional appropriation to the base. So it's not the base number.
Yeah. But if I could just add to that, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the way this works is that no number is fixed until it comes out of Representative Huntley's committee. So it's whether it's a blank or just or a number, it's kind of a suggestion. Mm-hmm. And it really all depends on what our budget target is and where Representative Huntley and others on that committee think that the money should be allocated with what we have. And so it's a bit of a fluid process at this time. That's my explanation anyway.
So, Representative Liebling, would it be my correct understanding then that the $10 million would be inclusive of the five other blanks, or are the five other unknown numbers in addition to the $10 million base?
Well, the ten is really...
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, again, it's the number is kind of a placeholder, as Representative Abler likes to say, but I think the way it's written, it's written to me as I'm looking at it that those are subsections of the 10 million. But again, I think this is something that, and I know Representative Huntley had his hand up, maybe he can shed some more light on how that would work.
Representative Huntley, can you respond?
Madam Chair and members, I wasn't going to talk specifically about this, but the way the general process has worked for the newer members is that these bills go through the policy committee, and you can vote against them or for them, depending on whether you really like it or don't like it. Then eventually it gets to my committee, which is the Finance Committee. And if I sort of like the bill, it'll probably get a hearing. But it will just be laid over. The term we use is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And then it sits there for 2-3 weeks or a month until we get the final numbers from whatever it's going to cost and whatever the governors and our fiscal notes show, and then we sit down privately, or I sit down privately, and decide which ones I like and which ones I don't like. And now I got to meet that budget target. And then I present a bill to the committee. And then the committee, if they don't like what I did, gets to amend everything I did, and you can add. But we will have a fixed financial target from the DFL leadership in this case, saying this is the amount of money you get to spend on health and human services, and so if you make amendments to my bill and move things around, you still have to stay below that target.
Thank you, Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Albright, Representative Albright, you?
I have no more. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I had originally a different issue, but I do think that as these things move forward, we really should look ahead to that tight fiscal list that Chair Huntley and the people who serve on his division will be working with, because I think it's going to be hard for us to meet all the hopes and dreams. And so I hope that as this moves forward, we'll really push other potential partners, because I think the beauty of these bills is that they are trying to surround the family with the right cost-effective services at the right time and not have them go to hospitalization and the most expensive things that you could do with less hope for you know, full recovery or stability. And I think that responsibility is for us too in those in these appropriations. For example, there's a blank for training for mental health professionals. I'd like to charge the Academic Health Center at the U of M with a responsibility for, first of all, including that in the core curriculum of preparing primary care people, both in nursing and other in physicians and other fields. But also, I suspect Dr. Schultz, who did a fine job today, would be a fine presenter at a continuing ed conference on this particular issue, and they can charge the doctors, you know, like they do, I'm sure, for other things that they do in support of the professions, rather than the thought that we always have to lead with our limited dollars here. And I would hope that we'd explore that. And the same thing with, you know, do we need someone to administer the grants and somebody to do consultation with school districts that don't get grants? Why can't those be the same people? You apply for the grants at this certain time. If you didn't lose, you'd get it. You hire people who are knowledgeable in that field, and they advise and support the others. And you know, and I just think we're going to have to get really creative to stretch the dollars as far as we can. But when we put blanks in bills like this, I think it tends to make each person who gets to write a fiscal note think, oh, I get two new people, and I get two new people. And, you know, I think we just need to kind of, as much as we can, push that, because our service system is way too inadequately supported, so that we want to maximize the dollars that go to the kids. But then my last question is on that partnership. Is there any possibility of some of these children, but I'm not sure what percent will be eligible for medical assistance, and so we would earn the federal match, and we'd provide the state funding. But, I mean, are there, and I assume we bill third party where we can, but, I mean, is there an expectation that, you know, school districts really work with us in pursuing those kind of, I mean, is there an expectation that, you know, school districts really work with us in pursuing those kind of resources, or is it up to the mental health clinic? I'm just trying to figure out, how does that work? We're going to have more families potentially eligible for medical assistance under the expansion, so that should help. But, you know, does that free up some resources or stretch the dollars further?
Ms. Abdahogan?
Madam Chair, Representative, it does. As part of the school-linked mental health grants, they're required to bill third-party payers, including private insurance, Medicaid, and Minnesota Care. I do have the percentage that it is, and I just can't remember off the top of my head. I think it's 37% is private insurance billed. And actually, even under the first episode program, we had talked about when it gets to finance, putting in an amendment saying that they would, of course, bill third-party payer to try to, again, keep it a more sustainable model.
Great. Representative Loeffler?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get my head around how I want to ask. I have a couple questions here. I am not an expert in any stretch on mental illness issues, but when you talked about, Ms. Aberholden, the support systems and so on, it just sort of made me think about my own life and family. And I have a son that was born with spina bifida. I'm a breast cancer survivor. And in those two situations in my life, we needed support. And I ended up in a support group, or starting a support group, actually, for moms with spina bifida and doing something with in the cancer area also. And I'm just curious, are there any private, just, I mean, is something the state needs to do, or are there people who are already involved, or, you know, it is a lot of money, you know, resources are tight. That's my first question. And the other one is just, could you just touch on the what mental health treatments you're talking about, what that would look like.
Mrs. Abner, hold in.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually NAMI provides family support groups and actually also a thing called NAMI Connection, where we train adults who are living well with a mental illness to lead a support group. But the first episode, what we found in not only at the University of Minnesota but in other places, because it's such a different illness than depression or bipolar disorder even, and with the young people, people with schizophrenia are very high risk for suicide, that they kind of like to leave the support group with a professional and connecting with them each other, but just making sure that they're okay. So this wouldn't be, I wouldn't see, like, you know, a million support groups supported around Minnesota, but just within those first episode programs. And then the mental health treatment as part of the school-linked mental health, it can be a wide variety. It can be individual therapy, things like cognitive behavior therapy as one example, which works really well, especially with kids who have depression and anxiety. It can be a support group therapy, a group therapy situation as well, family therapy, you know, so kind of all of those different kinds of things. And there's lots of different types of therapy, so cognitive behavior is just one.
Representative Loma? Yes. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Liebling. First, in Subdivision 4, is the school-linked mental health services, is that any way related to the same type, the bill that Representative Dabney had? Is this kind of on the same program line, so not necessarily saying it's going to be two different funding? Is this under that same? Does my question even make sense? You know what? I'm still not quite right from last night.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Schoen. Yeah, this is exactly the same provision. We have some overlapping provisions in these bills, so it's not something that will happen over here and over here. It's exactly the same thing.
Okay. Madam Chair, one.
Representative Schoen.
I wish you could quantify and put together numbers related to the cost of local government that we deal with on a yearly basis, just in my profession as a police officer dealing with these folks on the street. And every time that I transport somebody to the hospital just in my car for a crisis intervention or a crisis intervention center, even though they're, you know, Regents Hospital's 10, 12 minutes away. It's an hour, hour and a half of my time, and that happens many times a month. And just to look at that when you talk about what those costs are, that just off to the local governments as well, to the cities, counties as well. I wish you could put that into somehow and show us and say, we know that these investments are going to do well, and I believe it, and I am really excited to see us moving forward in a more aggressive way to really get out in front of these mental health issues, and I'm off my soapbox.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Okay, so we, Representative Liebling, renews her motion that House 5-296 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Bill passed.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so if there's no other business, committee is adjourned. Thank you.